The Debate.
Hello and welcome to Debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. $715 billion is what U.S. President Joe Biden wants for the Pentagon out of the $753 billion he has requested for the 2022 fiscal year for military spending. Now, this is an increase over the Trump administration's expenditure on the American military. The U.S. already spends more on its military than the next 10 countries combined. Washington calls the department which deals with the military as the Defense Department, but it appears the U.S. is spending billions not on actual defense, which would be at home or near home, but on total offense. The question is, why? Stay with me as we take a look at this and this debate. I'd like to welcome our correspondent out of Washington, D.C., Colin Campbell, and our next guest out of Iowa, Brian Terrell, who is a peace activist and political commentator. Thank you both for being with us. Colin, let's start off with you, and let's talk about his requests and what exactly it means.
Well, it means that he wants to raise the defense spending by about 2%. This is definitely more than the previous administration, at a time when many people believe there should be more money spent on domestic issues, such as education, such as health, especially amid a pandemic, many other issues that Americans are facing. But the Biden administration and the president believes that this defense spending is necessary in order to signal a message to China, which he believes is one of the nation's top adversaries when it comes to technology and defense. What this would do, though, if this budget were to pass, is to spend more on defense than the next 12 nations combined. It was previously 10, but I believe with this measure, this 2% increase, it would put that number at the next 12 nations combined. And he's raising some ire from some of his Democratic colleagues who are a little bit more left in the party. One of them, the head of the budget committee, and that would be Bernie Sanders. Former presidential candidate, who believes that this is a gross overstep in military spending. He believes that the administration should be looking at the adjustments and the overspending of the military in order to find those specific cuts and to save money. At the same time, however, we have to remember that we're dealing with a president who views himself as a little bit more of a centrist, or at least he wants to come across that way. And his Republicans on the other side of the aisle believe that with inflationary considerations in mind, this would be very stagnant as far as the proposal is concerned, meaning Republicans would like the president to propose more money for defense spending. So he has to walk this line in between those who are in his party, who are a little bit more left-leaning, who say that this is too much, and then those on the other side of the aisle who say that it's too little. And so he will need Republican support to pass this unless he's able to ram it through. But, of course, there are those who believe that within the Democratic Party, this could be very divisive when looking at the amount of money that's being spent and what it's being spent on.
All right. Thanks so much, Colin. Let me cross over to Brian. Brian Biden ran on the campaign of ending forever wars. What do you think that he meant by that? And do you think that Washington really wants to end its wars, for example, in Iraq and Afghanistan during this current administration?
I'm afraid not. I think we're seeing a different rhetoric now, but not much difference. In fact, we're an increase in spending. The United States, as Joe Biden said, if we don't get going, China is going to eat our lunch. But at present, the United States has 800 bases outside the United States in 70 different countries. China has one base in Djibouti outside of its borders. The provocations are coming from the United States. It's not China that's having military exercises in the ocean off its waters. It's the United States that with South Korea is having exercises within in the South China Sea. So this is really, as we're seeing with the war in Yemen and Afghanistan, is the Biden administration wants to talk differently about this. But we are a country that has one of our major exports now is weapons being sent to other countries, not to mention the weapons produced for ourselves.
Right.
And we don't produce anything. We don't make our make our shoes. We don't make our ballpoint pens. All the stuff comes from China, and it's because we have a wartime economy that we're dependent on this. And if war spending stopped, or slowed down, or even decreased, or even stopped increasing at the levels that even Biden's approving, our economy is really going to suffer become just dependent on war.
Stay with me, Brian. Let me introduce our next guest, Ian Williams, Senior Analyst, Foreign Policy, in Focus out of New York. Ian, good to have you with us. Your perspective, does the U.S. want to become even more militaristic? And is this the reason Biden wants to increase the Pentagon's budget even more? Or exactly why would this country need to spend even more money than, as our correspondent said, the next 12 nations combined?
I think there's a whole complex of reasons, and some of them are built into the country's infrastructure, political infrastructure. Lobbying always works. So you have huge lobbies that want to build weapons because they make money out of building weapons. You have progressive people who say, we don't really want to build weapons as a principle, but you make sure that aircraft carrier is built in my district. It's sort of Keynes by cannon. You know, they're pumping money into the local economies with weapons because, as your previous guest pointed out, the U.S. has stopped making things that people want to buy mostly, except for the weapons. And, you know, then, you know, there is a strategic look at the press, at the, you know, the China is not totally innocent. China is aggressively building up its arms, not nearly on the same scale. It's not nearly the total bad guy, but it has been building up weapons in particular areas. And, you know, if it wanted to persuade the U.S. to disarm, all China would have to do would be to say, we pledge not to attempt to take Taiwan by military means. And that would it. That would end it. It would remove half the excuses for the lobby who want to send more aircraft carriers to the Pacific, who to build more ships and planes and missiles.
Don't you think, Ian, that then there would be another excuse? I mean, we've had so many examples of actually countries saying, I'll use the one that I'm sitting in right now, Iran, and of course the whole excuse they wanted to exert military pressure, economic pressure, because of allegedly Iran and the bomb. And of course, Iran has said time and time again, and it's been proven that it has a peaceful nuclear program, but still the aggression continues. So you said if China would say that, then the U.S. would stop. But isn't it always after excuses, basically? It's a complex process.
Because, I mean, since you mentioned Iran, the Pentagon spent $20 billion or something like that on the literal ships that apparently don't work. But they were designed to deal with Iran because they worked out that you can have a huge lumbering aircraft carrier and a Revolutionary Guard in a motorboat with a limpet mine could sink it. You know, it's the disproportionate of forces here. So, you know, they're thinking of all sorts of wars. But one of the big problems is you've even got inter-service competition there. There are people racing to build bigger and fancier weapons that that look more spectacular, but are often very ineffective. For years, the U.S.'s best weapon was the Warthog, a close support aircraft for troops, which is what they were supposed to be for, and the Air Force didn't want that. The Air Force wanted super hypersonic max stealth craft that would fly in the space and do Star Wars stuff that nobody wanted, that there wasn't such a battle. There were battles on the ground, which they could afford. So, you know, apart from the geopolitics, it's really bad planning. They've got themselves bogged down.
Okay. Let me get Brian back in on this discussion. Brian, your take on this increased military spending keeps the hegemon at the time more and more in power, at least that's what it thinks, that it has to, it feels that it has to spend this much money. It's in a process of bullying other countries. If other countries do not listen to its demands, then it threatens it with military or even economic tactics. Is that what it's all about when we see this continual increase in military spending?
Yes, I think this is the what President Eisenhower warned about when he left office in the 1950s, a military-industrial complex that the United States is so dependent on economically on war that we're manufacturing wars so that we can sell weapons and not manufacturing weapons to fight wars. And I don't believe it has a lot to do with the geopolitics. I think you're right that if it weren't China, it would be Iran or be Russia or be Cuba or be Nicaragua, of all things, that we have these fears that these fears are being stoked to the American people, that there's somebody out there out for us, and that we need to, our response has to be overwhelming military force. And of course, we can. There's, you know, the threat to the United States now is really it's a nuclear war that could destroy everything, and that's part of the budget we're not talking about, because $50 billion also is going not to the Pentagon, mm-hmm. but to the Department of Energy to for the production, research and production of new nuclear weapons. The United States is on a huge program of developing new nuclear weapons at a time when it really ought to be disarming weapons that we simply don't need, and at a time when we have, as you mentioned, the COVID epidemic, not only here but around the world. There are whole countries that have not had any COVID vaccinations at all, and the security of the United States is much more dependent on having those vaccines get to places like Haiti and Iraq and Afghanistan than having our aircraft carriers and bombers. But we're not spending on that.
Okay. Well, Ian, despite spending so much money over the years, why is it that the United States has really not won a war since World War II? What does it mean?
Well, when they spend the money, they're spending it without too much regard for who the enemy is going to be. This huge amount of military spending was fighting the old Cold War, was fighting a huge land war in Europe, which never happened. The low-intensity wars that they've been fighting, the weaponry was huge, impressive, and pretty much ineffective, it can be. But, you know, everyone's looking at examples. You know, wars are serious business. People get killed. But nobody's really drawing these lessons. You know, you've got different procurement departments of the Pentagon. You've got the Air Force, the Marines, you've got the Navy, you've got the Army, all with their own wish lists. And it's part of the great American tradition. The officers who direct these procurement departments are on a revolving door. Within 6 months of them retiring on a huge pension, they then go and work for the very companies to which they were selling, that they were buying from a few weeks before. It's a completely closed web of what's really corruption, of swapping personnel. And then you've got Congress, where people who want to stay in Congress have to raise thousands of dollars a day just for their campaign expenses. So they go, like the guy who robbed banks, he went to banks because that's where the money was. These people go to the pharmaceutical companies to keep drugs protected. They go to military defense complexes because they're the ones with huge money. The ones who make the aircraft and the missiles, they are the big lobbyists. They, and not just them, but their constituents as well, the people who work for them in the shipyards and in the factories, they'll go and lobby. So everybody is busily doing the sort of Adam Smith thing, the invisible hand, but the hands are very visible, and they're always filled with greenbacks poking towards congressmen's buckets.
Okay, well, Brian, you heard Ian, and he was talking about as far as different types of lobbyists and as far as producing manufacturing various military equipment. But, it appears that you pointed out earlier that the main production or manufacturing now that's being done in the U.S. is the manufacturing of weapons and other military equipment. I mean, why couldn't lobbyists or others or various states concentrate on other type of manufacturing, which at one point in time the U.S. was known for?
Because that's what that's where the investments are. You know, the when President Biden a few weeks ago spoke about stopping the support for the Saudi war in Yemen, the CEO of Raytheon, one of the biggest war profiteers, told his stockholders, don't worry, peace is not going to break out anytime soon, and the Middle East is going to continue to be an area of growth for us. So this is, it's one of the terrible things that you ask the question about these wars that, that aren't won, and I'm afraid that they're not intended to be won. They're intended to be maintained, that they're intended to be permanent, or else if one... If one fades out just for out of exhaustion, another one gets picked up immediately after, because there's such incentive to keep these wars going. One of the horrible things about this too is that the Department of Defense of the United States has been rated one of the number one users of fossil fuel and producers of greenhouse emissions at a time when all this technology and all this money. You know, we don't have any problems, I don't believe, that cannot be solved, but we're not going to solve any of the world's problems, any of the United States' problems, and more than $715 billion is going to the military. Mm-hmm. We're not going to be a healthy society, we're not going to educate our children, we're not going to have usable infrastructure, we're on a downward spiral, and okay. A few people are getting richer and richer, but this has to stop.
Well, Ian, based on what Ryan just said, I want your take, too. I mean, your take on all this, because why does Washington continue to bait other countries into military conflicts, such as what is going on right now with China, American ships are in the South China Sea? I mean, does it want war when it hasn't been very successful in winning wars? Now, Ryan said basically the goal is just to keep the wars going. Do you agree with that, or what exactly is going on here?
Look, if you're going to be a cynic, you could describe the Cold War as the greatest economic expansion plan in human history. They managed to get all of the expansionary facts that you get from a real war without the destruction on themselves that it entails. They've taxed people, they've pumped huge amounts of money into the economy. And until Reagan came along and stopped workers getting proper rises, it actually benefited lots of people. People were thinking back then to the 30s and hunger and when factories were idle. Factories weren't idle because they were busy making helicopters and planes and rockets, and it kept everybody busy. It meant that people were going. This time there's a mentality, it comes again. Not only are the lobbyists always right, but the defense lobby, there hasn't been a defense budget that's been turned down by either side. It's increased every single year. And you have to put this in the context of this is a society where you can rally the voters and the congressmen against spending on a single-payer healthcare system, because that's obviously outrageous. It would actually be much cheaper. But no, that's unthinkable. But any addition to the defense budget is patriotic, and any attempt to diminish the budget or stop the budget expanding is a patriotic sellout to the unspecified enemy, whoever it is, that everybody falls for. So you have this perfect political machine for delivering money to the arms manufacturers. The problem is sometimes it does spill over into a war, and then they're not very good at it, as mm-hmm. we've seen. Okay. You know, the Middle East is filled with America's failed wars. Vietnam, I think a lot of Americans think that they won the Vietnam War because it's been wiped out of history, in a sense. You know, they think they won the Iraq War when, you know, they're about to leave with their tail between their legs.
Okay, let me get Brian back in. Sorry, Ian, I'm just about out of time. But Brian, I mean, according to the Social Progress Index, which ranks countries by the quality of life, the U.S. is rated 28. Now, why would a country which is supposed to be number one, the superpower in the world, but deteriorating rapidly, not concentrate more on its citizens and their overall quality of life instead of focusing so much on these bombs and nukes and other military equipment? And why, in your perspective, has the American people not risen up against this?
Oh, that last question, that really strikes to the heart, and I wish I knew why, because rising up against this has been my life goal for 40 years, and just found little pockets of it here and there that are encouraging, but there needs to be, there really needs to be revolutionary change here, and I think the kind of changes that we need to make are just that, revolutionary. We've seen the disappointment now in that many people have in the Biden administration, who are hoping that they'd see a turnaround, when really the choice is how much is the military budget going to increase, how much are we going to rob the treasury of the people all the more to feed the military industrial weapons complex. It's not a matter of whether we're going to do that or not. We don't have the our political mechanisms don't allow us.
Okay.
As mentioned, the power of the lobbyists. We don't have anything against that now. So.
All right. And on that note, I appreciate both of you being with us. We're out of time. Peace activist and political commentator Brian Terrell out of Iowa, and senior analyst foreign policy in Focus, Ian Williams out of New York. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on this debate. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Bye for now.
The month of Allah presents Ahkam, Islamic Commandments of Fasting by Hujjatul Islam Khakdaman.
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful, I'm very happy to be again with you with our second episode in our program, which is called Month of Allah. And I'll be continuing to explain about the Ahkam, specifically about this holy month. Previously, I talked about the intention in fasting, which is really important. But right now, I'm going to start with the first thing that we need to really care about, we need to regard, and that's not eating and not drinking, which is regarded as those kind of activities that break your fasting. It is really popular, if you ask anybody about fasting, they know that eating and drinking is forbidden in that period of time. But there are a couple of specific things and details about this matter of eating and drinking that need to be said. The important thing is anything which is regarded normally and regularly by the people that they eat or drink, you should not have that. Or things that are not regularly eaten, like dust, like soil, like anything. If it comes to the area of your mouth, and if you swallow it, it breaks your fasting. So the first point, which is important, is anything that is regularly eaten or irregularly. It's not important. All of it just breaks your fast. The second thing is that period of fasting, from Adhan to Adhan, a couple of hours, you need to have your fast on. The important thing is a couple of minutes before the Adhan of the morning and a couple of minutes after the Adhan of the Maghrib, we need to stop eating and drinking, and after that we can start. Why? Because we need to be sure, this is one of the important ahkam, we need to be sure that in this period, all of this period, we have not eaten and we have not drunk anything. To be sure, we need to stop doing that and prevent ourselves from eating and drinking a couple of minutes before and a couple of minutes after. The second thing is sometimes, it happens to people that, unintentionally, they just do something. For example, the morning has started, the Adhan has started, but a person is continuing to eat. And at that, moment, suddenly he understands that, he or she understands that, okay, Adhan has started. If that moment happens for you, you need to take out that piece of food in your mouth or anything that you are eating. You need to take it out, for example, after that, wash your hand, and start your fasting, because it has happened unintentionally. You have not been aware of that. You have not been aware of the fact that Adhan has started. But if you are aware, then your fast is not validated. It's in Arabic, like in the language of Deen, we say it's batil. It's not validated, so it breaks it. The second thing, the third thing, which is really important and happens so much for the people, is that the fact that after eating something, some parts of that remains, you know, lodged between our teeth or on your gum, for example, or some part of your mouth. And it, you know, drives some people to obsession. The fact that they need to wash their mouth is so much, or pick a, you know, toothpick and try to take all of those little pieces of, you know, food in your mouth out. It's not necessary. It's not obligatory to, you know, put every piece of food between your mouth or in your, you know, on your gum, between your teeth, out of your mouth. It's not necessary to do that. To do that, it's not obligatory. But if somebody is sure that if doesn't you don't use, you know, the toothbrush, if you don't use the toothpick, that amount of food is going to come down your mouth, and even it's going to happen. You're going to swallow it. Then you need to absolutely wash your mouth. You need to absolutely use your toothbrush. But otherwise, no, it's not necessary, because a lot of times it happens that those little pieces of, you know, food between your teeth, it just stays there up to the Adhan of Maghrib. And after that, you break your fast, it's normal. So don't let it, you know, get you into the obsession area, which is really bothering. Thank you very much, and be with us. We're going to continue.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
United States President Joe Biden has made a deal with Mexico, Guatemala, and Honduras to increase border security in order to prevent refugees from reaching the U.S. border. The leaders of Mexico and Guatemala criticized Biden for having initially sent compassionate messages that encouraged refugees to try and reunite with their families, only to find often brutal conditions and deplorable treatment at the U.S. border. Per capita, the U.S. accepts only a tiny amount of asylum seekers, and yet immigration appears to be the most talked about issue today. What's seemingly never discussed in the mainstream media is how U.S. foreign policy is so often the direct cause of the political instability and economic dysfunction which produces these regular refugee crises.
It feels odd to say even foreign policy, considering how deeply involved the U.S. has been in the development of Latin America, especially Central America, where a lot of these, you know, refugees and migrants are coming from. And this, you know, 100-year-long history is never addressed in the media. The wars in the 80s that Reagan waged against, you know, progressive governments and movements in Central America are never discussed. And even, like, extremely recent history, like the 2008 overthrow of the government in Honduras or the disputed 2017 election, are not discussed. And that is just recent history. It doesn't delve into, you know, the long history of colonialism, the Monroe Doctrine. People may have heard this in school, but they don't really understand what it means. It means the U.S. extracting resources from these countries. So it's no wonder that people would want to go from the areas the U.S. impoverished to the U.S., which has that wealth now.
Domestically, Republicans are being accused of fear-mongering about immigrants, while Democrats are being accused of using foreign immigration to distract from the unprecedented economic and health crises. The right to asylum is protected in international and U.S. law, but Biden appears to be following the same militaristic approach as his controversial predecessor, which many repeatedly called inhumane. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
Young black people have been hardest hit by unemployment during the pandemic, new research indicates. Over the past year, the UK jobless rate for young black people rose by more than a third to 35%, according to the Resolution Foundation think tank. That compared with a rate of 13% for young white people and a rate of 24% for young people of Asian descent. By the end of the year, unemployment among young black graduates had risen to 34%, up from 22% before the pandemic.
I graduated last year with a business degree, and I know COVID has, you know, really impacted the job market and all that stuff. But just being a black person as well, on top of that, it just makes things a lot harder.
Even if a black person has a degree and has just left university, they're finding it hugely difficult to get a job. And I think that's proof positive that Britain is a systemically racist society. Even in the year of 2021, we're seeing that time and time again, that the life chances, the opportunities available to black people are much worse than those available to the white population.
The findings follow the government's recent controversial report into race relations in British society, which claimed the UK does not suffer from institutional racism and should be a model for other white majority nations. Yet the research from the Resolution Foundation, along with other racial disparity statistics, paints a very different picture, which critics argue the government's report failed to acknowledge.
In the British capital, London, young black males were 19 times more likely to be stopped and searched than the general population, and were 28 times more likely to be stopped on suspicion of carrying weapons than the general population. Black people were 6.5 times more likely to be fined than white people for breaking COVID-19 regulations, and more than 4 times more likely to die from COVID-19 than white people.
Black Britons, African Caribbeans and Asians face systemic racism. They're 9 times more likely to be stopped and searched by the police. As women, 3 times more likely to die in childbirth. Were 60% of the doctors and nurses and health frontline workers who died at the very beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic. And for the government's report to say that institutional racism doesn't exist is just a kick in the teeth.
Foundation's findings exposed that COVID had widened already existing gaps between the UK's ethnic groups, and they've urged for special efforts to ensure that young people from hard-hit ethnic backgrounds had access to quality education, training options, and where needed, financial support for full-time study. But many will feel the government may not have the remedy for this issue while they refuse to accept the diagnosis, systemic racism. Ahmed Cabello, London.
As the fasting month of Ramadan arrives, Afghans happily welcome it with honor and pride. In the meantime, poverty and low control over prices in the market by the government are major problems that poor families are facing. That is why they call on responsible bodies to take strict measures in order to control the market during the holy month.
We want businesses to think about difficulties of the poor during the fasting month of Ramadan. Government bodies also need to fully control food prices and prevent sharp price hikes during Ramadan to help poor families and individuals.
Fasting Afghans also see this month as an opportunity for not only strengthen their bonds with God, but also to further help and support the underprivileged in society. That is one of the fundamental teachings of Islam.
This is a religious and humanitarian responsibility of every single Muslim to help poor people, especially orphans and widows who have no breadwinner, and Ramadan creates opportunities for us to fulfill our responsibility in this regard.
Besides other challenges, the COVID-19 pandemic in Afghanistan is also a problem on the way of fasting Afghans. This is because they religiously organize big gatherings during the holy month each year. The continuation of terrorist attacks and bombings during the fasting month of Ramadan is one of the other headaches for Afghans, especially for military forces who are either in the front lines or inside their posts and bases across the country. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Iranian Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi announces Iran's decision to increase the level of uranium enrichment from 20 to 60% and to install an additional 1,000 centrifuges at its Natanz facility, the target of a recent act of sabotage. Araghchi broke the news upon arriving in Vienna for another joint commission meeting aimed at reviving the nuclear deal. He said the International Atomic Energy Agency has been informed.
We just sent a new letter to the agency saying that we would start from tomorrow enrichment up to 60%. And that is for Iran needs in to produce certain radio isotopes needed for certain medical treatments.
Araghchi said the damaged centrifuges in Natanz would be replaced by more advanced ones, and that things would go back to normal there in the coming weeks. Signatories of the nuclear deal are expected to meet in Vienna on Thursday as negotiations continue. Iran insists that all US sanctions should be lifted and their removal verified before it goes back to full compliance.
We believe that this round of negotiations is the time for the US to present the list. And I hope that I can go back to Tehran with the list of sanctions which should be lifted. Otherwise, I don't believe we can continue like this. Otherwise, it would be a waste of time, actually. So let's see.
Informal discussions have already begun here with the hope of reaching an agreement on the list of U.S. sanctions that need to be lifted, after which Iran says it will discuss the verification process. Homaleski, Vienna.
Lining up for donated clothes and a warm meal, more than 100 men who have survived Western-backed wars in the Middle East and Africa and the death-defying journey to get to the UK. A former bank employee, Keenan, is a Syrian asylum seeker living in temporary accommodation in the Welsh city of Cardiff.
I didn't leave my country in the first 5 years of the war. I left after 8 years and a half. I tried and did my level best to stay in my home country and not being a refugee. Refugee is not a good thing to be. It's not an option.
Before Cardiff, this father of one and his fellow asylum seekers had been housed in a dilapidated army barracks in the coastal village of Penali. Economics graduate Fateh worked as a risk analyst in his home country.
When I first came here, I had no idea about military camps, but we put into camps and it was a horrible experience.
The UK government says it takes the well-being of asylum seekers extremely seriously, and any abuse is completely unacceptable. But the organizer of the welcoming event in Cardiff, who has also spent a lifetime combating racism, believes the government has failed to live up to its obligation.
Without a shadow of a doubt, they failed. They failed miserably. Some of the initial accommodation is abysmal. We have seen people rehoused in shared houses where they have to share one bathroom, one kitchen, with dangerous kitchen facilities.
After surviving the dangerous journey to Europe, they were greeted with this: far-right protests in Dover last year.
Here in Cardiff today, an act of kindness and compassion towards asylum seekers who come here from far and wide, from the Middle East and Africa, among them doctors and engineers. Contrast this with the kind of hostility and hate they have been receiving from some people who think that their country is under invasion by irregular immigrants.
One of the consequences of coronavirus has meant the country's already overloaded asylum application system has ground to a halt, leaving these men living a life of wait and see.
Many people have been living here in limbo, not knowing when their asylum process is going to be progressed. And of course you have some people here who are separated from their family. They have family.
Britain remains the fifth most favorite European destination for refugees and asylum seekers, way behind Germany, France, Spain, and Greece. Keenan and other refugees and asylum seekers have survived war and the perilous voyage here, but their journey to call it their new home is yet to end. Saeed Pourreza, London.
While millions of Yemenis are suffering from a severe fuel shortage due to Saudi Arabia's continued seizure of oil ships, an Emirati oil tanker named Saga has arrived at Bir Ali port in Shabwa in eastern Yemen to transport 115,000 tons of Yemeni crude oil to the UAE.
Oil smuggling carried out by the Saudi-led coalition in southern and eastern provinces has cost Yemen more than $7 billion over the past 2 years. Annually, more than 14 million barrels of crude oil are being smuggled illegally through several ports in Shabwa province, which is under the control of Saudi Arabia.
Meanwhile, Yemen's petroleum company says another oil tanker named Apollitaris is on its way to Deva port in Al Mukalla to move more than 300,000 tons of oil to an unknown destination.
Yemen is being systematically plundered by Saudi Arabia. An estimated $145 million of oil income is being looted monthly. Recently, an Emirati ship arrived at Shabwa port to plunder 1 million barrels of crude oil, and there is another ship coming from China to transport over 2 million barrels of crude oil.
Yemenis have been suffering from a harsh shortage of fuel due to the continued detention of 10 patrol ships by Saudi Arabia, while the vessels are inspected and authorized by the UN through verification and inspection mechanism.
Yemenis say plundering their oil is an illegal act that reveals the real reasons for the years-long war on their country by Saudi Arabia and its allies. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
It was a pitch battle in garrison city of Rawalpindi near Pakistan's capital Islamabad. The violent clashes erupted after what protesters blamed the government to have backed out of its agreement with them to expel the French ambassador to Pakistan over the repeated incidents of public display and republication of blasphemous cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad. Many died and dozens of others injured from the both sides in the clashes after the protesters blocked the major railways and road links. Protesters claimed that at least 10 of their companions were killed and over 100 were arrested by the police.
This government doesn't care about the dignity of our prophet. Obviously, people take to the streets to show their anger. We gave the government 5 months to expel the French ambassador, but they did not expel him. We will continue our protests until our demand is met, which is the expulsion of French ambassador.
Pakistan has a history of similar violent protests over the frequent incidents of blasphemy of the Prophet under the guise of freedom of expression in the West. Protecting the honor of the Prophet is the most sensitive issue in Pakistan, which attracted millions of people on the roads in the past.
Sending the French ambassador back may be a kind of a step which again could provide an immediate relief as far as the domestic political scene is concerned, but that is not going to solve the problem. Today it is France, tomorrow it will be another country, and so we need to be having a comprehensive campaign.
Pakistan has been under pressure from Paris-based anti-money laundering outfit the Financial Action Task Force, which placed Pakistan on grey list few years ago on the charges of terror financing. Now Pakistan needs French support together with other countries to come out of the grey list, because of which Islamabad is reluctant to expel French ambassador. However, rising anti-French sentiments in Pakistan are leaving little option with the government but to expel French ambassador. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
restaurateurs, gym owners, and business people from various other industries have continued to stage protests across Italy demanding the government to immediately lift the ban on their activities. A protest dubbed Io Apro, I Open, was staged in central Rome. Hundreds of angry business people tried to head towards the parliament building but were met by police in riot gear and had to detour to nearby San Silvestro Square. Here they shouted, "Freedom, and let us get back to work," with some hurling smoke flares and other objects.
Under Italy's current red and orange zone restrictions, restaurants remain closed at night and are open for takeaway only during the day, whereas swimming pools and fitness centers are closed all day.
We are exasperated by the situation and by the way the police treat us. This is just repression. They do not even allow us to demonstrate. The government must let us return to our work. We have lost 60-70% of our earnings.
The protest turned nasty when protesters infiltrated by alt-right activists and professional organizers of social unrest threw firecrackers and objects at police. Officers charged the protesters after they tried to breach a police cordon.
The government keeps ignoring us. My shop has been closed since October, but the rent and all bills must be paid anyway. How can we continue this way? I am afraid some people will resort to extreme acts.
Meanwhile, restrictions were eased across most of Italy after six regions were downgraded from red to orange on Monday. However, Prime Minister Mario Draghi has said Italy will have no moderate risk yellow zones this month in an attempt to keep the spread of the virus down while his government tries to step up a much-delayed vaccination campaign. Max Civili, Rome.
Increasing the number of...
Boris Johnson is the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom. That is a fact. But according to a senior former British civil servant, Philip Reitcroft, the COVID-19 pandemic has seeded the idea of a Prime Minister who speaks for England alone. In a study looking at the issues of devolution from inside the UK state machinery, the former permanent secretary to the Brexit department stated that the 300-year-old union is in deep peril due to no defined strategy by Westminster.
In the context of COVID, where each of the constituent nations devolved governments, are essentially self-governing. This has inculcated a sense that Britain is not a unified nation, the UK is not unified, and it's never been more divided and never been more angry. And to all intents, I think it's fair to say that Boris Johnson, at least unofficially, is the Prime Minister of England only. He doesn't seem to care about the union.
The crisis has been exacerbated amid growing momentum for a second referendum on Scottish independence, with a recent poll showing that pro-independence parties would win 79 of 129 seats in Holyrood in the upcoming elections. Moreover, there's also a growing independence movement in Wales that will add to Westminster's woes. Meanwhile, in Northern Ireland, there's been a serious deterioration of relations between the nationalist and loyalist communities following the implementation of the Brexit deal, which has resulted in some of the worst street violence to have taken place in recent years.
I think Northern Ireland has been used as a pawn. It's been used as a pawn by the British government. It's been used as a pawn by the European Union.
The report, co-authored by Professor Michael Kenny, claimed it was political decision-making made by Westminster mixed with a lack of consultation with dissolved governments and confused messaging that has caused widening divisions, with Reitcroft claiming that Boris Johnson's muscular brand of unionism had asserted the value of the union rather than demonstrating it.
Boris Johnson and his crew of hard right ideologues have substituted flag-waving British nationalism for clear-headed policy designed to make people in different parts of the UK feel they're part of something united rather than increasingly polarised. And when the flag-waving starts, the thinking stops. And when the thinking stops, the road to ruin is set. And this UK is on a road to ruin.
The warnings laid out in this new report are stark. Unless there's a change in strategy from Downing Street, then the future of the United Kingdom as four nations, England, Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland, is in doubt. Ahmed Kabbalah, London.
the month of God. In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Salam and welcome to the program. We are with you with another episode of this special series for Ramadan. Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, says, if the servants of God were aware of the blessings and realities of Ramadan, they would wish the entire year would be Ramadan. He also says, indeed, the gates of sky are open in the first night of Ramadan and will not be closed till the end of the month. Ramadan is the month of further acquaintance with the Noble Quran to benefit from this heavenly book. Imam Baqir, the fifth infallible successor of Prophet, peace upon him, says, everything has a spring, and the spring of the Quran is the month of Ramadan. The Noble Quran has been called, in the words of the Prophet and the infallible Imams, and also the Quran itself, as light, remedy, truth, guidance, criterion, and so on. In view of this, close acquaintance and companionship with the Quran is in fact companionship with light and truth. This requires knowing it and being in constant contact with it. This will result in calm and serenity. Obviously, this has a meaning beyond merely recitation of the Quran, although recitation has its own impact and is considered as the first step for understanding the Quran. Companionship with the Quran should result in improvement of behavior and acquisition of moral virtues. The blessed month of Ramadan is the best opportunity for this purpose, as it is the month in which this heavenly book has been revealed. In Islam, fasting is divided in four categories: obligatory, recommended, disapproved, and forbidden. The most famous obligatory fasting is the fasting of the month of Ramadan, which every mature Muslim should observe it. Recommended fasting includes many days in year, but the 2 months of Rajab and Shaban are famous in this regard. Disapproved fasting is the fasting of the day of Ashura, or 10th, of the Islamic month of Muharram. And finally, forbidden or haram fasting is the fasting of Eid al-Fitr, feast of fasting after the end of Ramadan, and Eid al-Adha, that is the feast of sacrifice on 10th of the Islamic month of Dhul-Hajjah. In addition to the fasting of the blessed month of Ramadan, there is obligatory fasting in other conditions too. Fasting of Atonement and fasting on behalf of one's deceased parents are two kinds of obligatory fasting. Fasting is obligatory for a person who is healthy enough. If he or she is sick or becomes sick as a result of fasting, it is forbidden for him or her. If the doctor says that fasting is harmful for one's health, while he or she knows, through experience, that it is not, he or she should fast. On the contrary, if the doctor tells one that fasting is not harmful for him or her, while he or she knows, through experience, that it is, he or she shouldn't fast. In Ayah 60 of Surah Ghafir of the Noble Quran, God has expressly said that He answers anyone who calls Him. He says, "And your Lord has said, call me, and I will answer you. Indeed, those who are disdainful of my worship will enter hell in utter humility." If the heart becomes familiar with the remembrance of God, God will undoubtedly answer his prayer. But how should we call God? We are servants, and God is the Lord of the entire universe. Anyone who refuses to worship God will enter hell with humility. It is narrated from the infallible Imams that they said, "Worship for the fear of hell is the worship of slaves. Worship for the sake of paradise and rewards of hereafter is the worship of merchants. But worship out of gratitude towards God is the worship of free people." The seventh infallible Imam and successor of the Prophet, Imam Musa Kazem, peace upon him, has taught us a supplication which is recited after every daily obligatory prayer in the month of Ramadan. He says, "My God, in this year and every year till the end of my life, and as long as I am in comfort and ease, grant me the pilgrimage to your sacred house, Holy Kaaba, and do not deprive me of reaching and visiting the noble places and pilgrimage to the tomb of your messenger. May your greetings be upon him and his progeny. My God, help me in all my needs in this world and hereafter. My God, I ask you, among the ordained affairs that have been definitely determined in the night of Qadr and will not be returned or changed, to place me among the pilgrims of your sacred house, the pilgrims whose Hajj is accepted, whose effort is praised, whose sins are forgiven, and whose evil deeds are expiated. And grant me long life in the way of your servitude, and provide me with ample sustenance, and pay my trust and debts."
We give people.
The Illegals.
There's been a mess at the U.S. southern border with Mexico, one that is at least more blatant today under President Biden. More and more so-called illegal aliens arrive at the U.S. border, putting pressure on the administration to handle what some believe is a crisis.
Many of these young girls that are coming across are being sexually assaulted and raped.
I mean, when February ended, we thought, wow, that was rough. March outdid it by a long shot.
Hello and welcome to We the People. I'm your host, Mila Javamagi. In reality, the so-called illegals are desperate human beings escaping violence, poverty, and mafia. They've left their countries in Central and Southern America in the hope of fleeing persecution or seeking a better life. And here they are, stranded at the border with an uncertain future hanging somewhere in the middle of a game played by the most powerful men in America. In this episode, we analyze the latest developments at the U.S. border with Mexico. Thank you for staying with us.
There are still continuous reports of illegal crossings, detentions, and even murder and sexual abuse in regard to the migrants. Many of the migrants intend to join their loved ones on the other side of the border through Texas's Rio Grande Valley, the busiest corridor for illegal crossings.